The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and a happy Easter and a happy Passover to those who are celebrating those holidays. Tonight, we will be celebrating workplace culture, and we'll begin by welcoming back to the show one of my favorite guests, Jim Canales, the president of the Barr Foundation, who draws an interesting link between humility and curiosity.
The Building Movement Project presented some findings on this very issue. They had done a very comprehensive survey, including thousands of people from around the country, to look at this question of what were some of the impediments to achieving greater diversity in leadership roles. And this is a question, as you know, we have been struggling with as a sector for many years.
And you will also hear from George Bratt, the chairman and founder of Prime Genesis. Two out of five executives transitioning into a new position will not succeed. There are several reasons for this, one of which is delivery.
Delivery is not getting done what needs to get done. And this is the second big thing. And gosh, everybody's seen this or heard this. People going, oh, they just couldn't get it done. But if you ask them, they say, you know, the organization didn't give me the resources I needed to get done what I needed to get done.
And we'll round out the hour with some better than most corporate culture segments and a Take Five lightning round or two. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, April 1st. The MasterCard Foundation has announced a commitment of $100 million in support of efforts to address youth unemployment in Rwanda. U.S. News & World Report and the Aetna Foundation have announced a new initiative to rank and identify the healthiest communities in the United States. And according to the report, Falls Church, Virginia is the healthiest community in the country. It was followed by Douglas and Broomfield counties in Colorado. Los Alamos County in New Mexico came in number four, and Dukes County, Massachusetts, that's where Martha's Vineyard is located, was number five. The Michael J. Fox Foundation has announced a new $6 million effort to investigate the causes of Parkinson's disease. Last year, nonprofit and public organizations signed leases for 6 million square feet of space throughout New York City. That's a 46% increase from 2016, this in a new report from Cushman & Wakefield. According to the Wall Street Journal, nonprofits are quietly keeping New York's commercial property sales market afloat. DonorsChoose.org, a website where public school teachers can post funding requests for classroom materials and projects, has announced a donation of $29 million in cryptocurrency from enterprise blockchain solutions provider Ripple and its executives to fund every request on the site as of March 27th. And finally, there have been significant efforts in the nonprofit world to have staffs and leadership that are more diverse, more representative of American society, and reflective of the communities they serve. But despite all those efforts, not much has changed. And covering that story for the Chronicle Philanthropy has been Tim Sandoval, who's with us now. So, Tim, what does the latest research show, and is any progress being made?
Yeah, well, after two decades of talking about diversifying leadership roles and diversifying board members, no, there really hasn't been that much action taken by nonprofits to ensure that diversification is taking place. White people essentially fill out 9 of 10 board chair and CEO positions in nonprofits nationwide. And that figure hasn't really changed much since 1994, when Board Source and a leading governance organization first did its survey measuring this. So the answer, in short, is no, there really hasn't been a lot of progress on this over the years.
So, Tim, why is this the case? What do nonprofit leaders and experts in the field say as to why we have not been able to make more progress?
Right. Yeah. Well, they say that there hasn't been a lot of action by nonprofits. There hasn't been a lot done in the way of recruiting people of color. Nonprofits sort of feel that, you know, using their normal processes, their normal recruiting processes that they've been using for years and years, they haven't really gotten that many diverse candidates. So there probably just isn't that much diverse talent. So they sort of believe that that becomes sort of kind of the thought in nonprofits. Today, you know, and also they haven't really done a lot to review the qualifications for certain jobs. So things, items like volunteering experience. experience? You know, should volunteering experience really be something that is a core qualification? You know, especially when people coming out of college maybe don't, you know, if they're people of color or they're people who come from a lower socioeconomic background, will they really have volunteering experience kind of college?
Finally, are there any organizations that have addressed this issue of diversity successfully? And if so, what have they done?
Yeah, so one organization that I profiled was LIFT, which is an anti-poverty organization. So what they've done is they've really looked internally to find people that they think that they can recruit to leadership positions and really taken a chance on many of them. So when, you know, for leadership positions today, what people want to see is a lot of fundraising experience, for instance. One thing that's kind of come out of, you know, a lot of these talks about diversity is that people of color often don't get the fundraising experience that they need to become leaders, you know, and to have the experience to kind of join the leadership ranks. So LIFT is really kind of taken a chance on a lot of people and said, hey, these people seem like they have the charisma, they seem like they have all of the kind of skills and social skills necessary to be a leader and to fundraise, frankly, and we can kind of build them up as leaders rather than kind of the traditional way, which would be these people already have a lot of connections, they're already, you know, pretty experienced in fundraising, so let's just bring them on board as a leader.
Well, thanks very much, Tim, for shining a light on this all-important issue and for sharing it with us.
Appreciate it, Denver.
I'll be back to speak with Jim Canales, the president of the Barr Foundation, right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. Before you give to charity, go to CharityNavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. CharityNavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
And in our ongoing series entitled Better Than Most, where we examine the corporate cultures of the best nonprofits and philanthropic enterprises, it's a pleasure to have with us this evening Jim Canales, the president of the Barr Foundation. Good evening, Jim, and welcome back to the Business of Giving.
Thanks, Denver. Pleasure to be with you again.
Culture is such an amorphous notion to so many. How would you describe it, and why have you made it such an important priority wherever you have been?
Well, the reality is, you know, as you know, there's that famous, I think it was the Peter Drucker saying about, you know, strategy and culture, and obviously speaking to the, you know, it's the imperative of having an effective culture to drive any kind of strategy that's going to have the kind of impact that you want to have. And so both at the Irvine Foundation and now at the Barr Foundation, you know, I've realized the imperative of sustaining, of nurturing, of building, and ideally of kind of co-crafting the kind of culture that allows us to do our philanthropy in the most effective and impactful way. So there are a lot of elements to it, which I hope we'll have a chance to explore today.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you arrived at Barr several years ago, you said that you were concerned less about what the foundation did than how you did it. Describe to us the how that you employ as you go about your work.
Well, so that comment that I made was very much a reflection of the particular circumstance here at Barr, which, as you know, is one where we have living donors, the Hofstetters who founded the Barr Foundation now 20 years ago and who serve on the board, and we have other trustees as well, but Barbara is the chair of the board and Amos is also on the board. The culture that they have created here at the Barr Foundation is, in my view, a really special culture and one that is very very much illustrative and a manifestation of their values. And so the more that I engaged with them in the series of conversations that led to our joint decision to have me come here, the more it became clear to me that while they wanted Barr to have great impact on the issues that we all care about, they also took a special care that they wanted to be sure that the culture of this environment is something that would sustain over time. And that's a culture that is deeply grounded in a sense of humility.
Mm-hmm.
It's a culture that is very much about a spirit of curiosity and feeling that there's a lot more that we can learn by listening rather than necessarily talking. It's a culture that believes strongly in the importance of investing in leadership and then providing leaders with the autonomy and the authority to do their very best work with our resources. And I would say that investment in leadership extends to our internal culture, where I think we feel very strongly that we want to hire talented people and give them lots of room, not only for their own growth, but also room for them to advance the ideas that they think are important for what we are trying to achieve as a foundation. So those elements, when I said, you know, the kind of how in some ways was as important as the what, ensuring that we sustain those elements has been a key priority for me in the 3.5 years I've been here.
Picking up on that last notion you talked about, hiring and retaining people, that's one of the biggest problems we have in the sector right now. Social enterprises and purpose-driven businesses are often taking some of our most talented people. So how do you hire such good people? And speak a little bit more about what you do to develop them and retain them.
So one of the things that I think about in philanthropy is that early in my career, somebody said to me, you know, philanthropy really isn't a career. It's something that you bring, you know, the various skills and experiences that you have had to it. And I think that there's some truth in that. And that's not in any way to diminish, and I sit here as an example of somebody who has spent most of my career in philanthropic organizations. So it's not to diminish people who have had that kind of experience. But it is to say that philanthropy is a kind of a unique environment in that you have a blend of people, you know, some of whom have deep functional expertise, whether it's in accounting or HR or IT, and that's kind of the kind of expertise you can apply in many different settings. But on the program side, you often find that you have people who come in and out of philanthropy, who have worked in a nonprofit for many years, bring great depth in a particular area such as education or climate, and then bring that experience to bear on their work from a foundation setting. So all of that is to say that one of the things I think about and we think about here at the foundation is the fact that it's probably unlikely that staff at the Barr Foundation are going to see themselves here for the remainder of their career.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, we think a lot about how is it that we can invest in ongoing training and professional development and opportunities for education advancement for our staff so that it positions them not only to do great work here and to ensure that they're continuing to learn and bring that to bear on the work at Barr, but it also encourages them to think about what makes sense for them in life after Barr. And, you know, we have explicit conversations during our performance review process about how people are thinking about that. We don't think that that should be a taboo question. We don't think that if somebody is talking about career aspirations beyond Barr, that that should be interpreted that they're ready to leave, or that somehow if a supervisor raises a question, that that should be interpreted as we're trying to subtly send a signal that they need to be thinking about their next step. Quite the opposite. It's more to instill that spirit that these are the kinds of conversations that you have in settings where you're expecting high performance and where you want people to really thrive and excel in whatever environment they're in.
Yeah, those are real and authentic conversations, because those conversations have always been going on, but they've been going on silently. So you might as well just get them out there and have these honest discussions about them, and each side benefits tremendously from that. You have brought some tremendous innovation in your short time at Barr. Speak to us about a culture of innovation and some of the things that you have done to foster it.
Well, I think that it stems, you know, I come back to some of these core values at the foundation. And when I arrived, soon after I arrived, one of the first exercises that we went through is a set of trustees. And at the time, it was just me and the Hostetters as trustees of the foundation. And the three of us sat down and spent several work sessions explicitly discussing what were the values of the foundation and how would we think about expressing those. We, interestingly enough, in the 16 years prior to my arrival, level, there was no express statement of values that had been explicitly written down. I think a lot of people, once they were here, came to understand certain values as important, such as humility. But there was no expression of that. And I felt it was important to give voice and to give language to what we thought was important. And one of the values that we spoke about was curiosity, and the importance of maintaining that spirit of curiosity. And I think it's in some ways a different kind of expression of humility. It's a sense that we at the foundation don't have all the answers, and one of the ways that we manifest that is by being openly curious, by asking lots of questions, by trying to be, you know, learners about the work that we're doing, and always feeling that there's more that we can learn. And I think that's, when I think about innovation, I think it's bringing that spirit of curiosity, that quest for learning to our work, that I think ultimately leads us to be more open to new ideas and ideally more innovative. One thing you will find on our website is we don't really expressly speak of innovation as a core value of the foundation, and that's intentional. I worry a little bit that, today we find that lots of people are tossing around innovation as a way to describe how they work. And while I hope we are innovative at the Barr Foundation, I don't think that we become innovative by saying we're innovative or by saying that we embrace innovation. I think we become innovative by bringing other kinds of qualities to our work, including that spirit of curiosity and questioning.
Absolutely. It's a byproduct. I've admired how you've leveraged opportunities that have come along to make a statement about your culture and to reinforce your culture. And a good example of that would be when you moved offices several years ago. What were some of the values you considered when designing your new office space?
So we had a great opportunity when soon after I arrived here. When I arrived, we were bursting at the seams in a 5,000-square-foot space, which is a beautiful historic building in Boston called the Pilot House. It's an 1845 brick-and-beam construction, and it's on the harbor, and it's absolutely stunning and a beautiful space. But we knew that both for the needs at that point in time, but more importantly for future needs, as we were contemplating growth and expansion, and we've already grown by about 10 staff members in the time that I've been here, we knew that that space wasn't going to work for us. So we had the opportunity to actually move into some adjoining space that actually is adjacent to that. So we were able to create one large 15,000-square-foot contiguous space on the fourth floor of the building that we're in. And it gave us an opportunity as a staff and as trustees to take a step back and say, what do we want that space to say about the work of the foundation? And one of the very first questions that we asked ourselves, and we spent a lot of time as a staff thinking about, is what do we want the visitor experience at the Barr Foundation to be? We begin with the premise that, you know, in philanthropy there is an inherent power imbalance, and as a result, many people who come to the foundation, I think, very much feel that power imbalance, and I think oftentimes the meetings at the foundation can probably create some sense of anxiety or a sense of, you know, this is a high-stakes meeting that I'm having, and because of that, we wanted to make sure that the space was as welcoming, as comfortable, and in essence as sort of centered on that visitor experience as possible. So we obviously tried to create a very nice welcoming lobby area with, you know, a place where people could get coffee. We actually, you know, and given the seasons here in Boston, we actually created a small kind of mud room where people could come in, take their boots off, hang up their coat, be able to have a place to get settled before they have to go into a meeting. We thought about conference rooms that had that level of kind of, you know, again, sort of comfort and a welcoming quality to them, and you'll see in the space as well, because of a commitment to transparency and openness, there is a lot of glass in the space by design. All the offices are pretty open offices, so you can pretty much see into anybody's office at any point in time, and we felt that that was very important, and that it conveyed a sense that, you know, this is a very open, transparent culture, and it also conveyed a sense that, you know, it's a place that we want people to feel comfortable. We also have, in the last year, we've been able to work on a great project, which is to use the space as an opportunity to showcase some great contemporary artists.
Oh, wow.
who speak to some of the social issues that we work on. And that's been hugely exciting in terms of an opportunity to support living contemporary artists, both from around the world, but also locally here in New England. And we're very excited about that. And in fact, we've put that entire collection up on our website. So even if people aren't able to come to our offices, they can see, see the great art that is being made by some wonderful artists from around the country and around the world, for that matter.
That is very cool. You know, the foundation world can be a bit opaque, as you mentioned before, and it's slowly but surely becoming more transparent. And I love your story about the glass. What are some of the other things that you're doing to continue to evolve as a transparent institution?
Well, I would say there are a number of things. I mean, one, it begins with, trying to be as open about the work that we are doing. And I think, we've made a big effort and a big investment in our website, for example. When I arrived, we had a website, but it, for example, did not list all of the grants that the foundation had made. It had illustrative grants rather than a comprehensive list. And there wasn't a whole lot on the website, about what we were learning from our work, about the work in the field. And so that's all shifted. I mean, now you can go to our website. We try to provide pretty thorough descriptions of what we're interested in funding, what the priorities of the foundation are. There is a comprehensive listing of all the grants that we have made for the last number of years. But we have a blog, and I blog with some great frequency. People on the staff blog. We invite some of our partners to do guest blogs for us. And we see that blog as an opportunity to share some of what we're learning, to spotlight areas where we think, there's work that's happening that's really creative and having impact on the issues that we care about, to add our voice to the issues that we think are important in the areas of arts and creativity and climate and education, which are the core areas of focus for the foundation. And in essence, to try to lend a spirit of transparency and try to diminish as much of the opacity that I think can happen in foundations. I don't know the statistic exactly, but I know the Foundation Center tracks it, but I'm stunned by the very relatively small number of foundations that even have websites. So it seems to me that it's a pretty low bar if transparency is defined as simply having a website. I think the bar should be higher, and I think it should be not just having a website, but also having that website in some pretty thorough ways talk about the work that you're doing, and not just what you're funding and who you're funding, but also this piece of, what are you learning and what's working and perhaps even what's not working.
Yeah, we had Brad Smith on the show, the president of the Foundation Center, and if I recall the interview correctly, I think that number, Jim, was 7%, which is truly astounding. 7%
of foundations. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah,
pretty remarkable.
Websites. Boy, I tell you, one of the biggest challenges I think we have in the sector is around diversity, inclusion, and equity. And everybody seems to be working on it, but nobody's getting it quite right. But they know it's a work in progress, and they're working harder and harder at it. What are you doing?
Well, it's interesting that you raise it, because just last week here in Boston, we were part of a forum that was organized by the Boston Foundation, where the Building Movement Project presented some findings on this very issue. They had done a very comprehensive survey, including thousands of people from around the country, to look at this question of what were some of the impediments to achieving greater diversity in leadership roles. And this is a question, as we have been struggling with as a sector for many years, arguably for decades. And as one of the common themes that you often hear is that the impediments are largely around, people of color need more training, or mm-hmm. people of color need greater educational advancement. That it's basically an issue that's centered on what do we need to do to help people of color be better prepared and better equipped and better qualified to move into certain roles. And this study, I believe the title of it was Building to Lead, the study sort of turned it the other direction and looked and provided some data that showed that actually it's not quite true. I mean, people of color have a great deal of experience. People of color have a lot of educational achievement. And when you look at some of the statistics relative to their white peers, they're pretty similar. Hmm. And so what the researchers ultimately turned to was that maybe it was less about that, and it was more about the readiness and willingness of the institutions to embrace people of color in these kinds of leadership roles. And what were we seeing by ways of impediments in terms of potential systemic bias that's taking place in our hiring processes? What were we seeing in terms of the kinds of expectations that we were placing on people of color moving into roles? There was a whole piece of the study that was exploring how certain people of color often feel that there are expectations placed upon them to be representative of certain groups, and that that begins to get wearing at times. So I thought it was a very interesting study, and it's just the first round of work that they have done, and there's a deeper analysis that they will be doing, especially for us here in Massachusetts. The Boston Foundation, you can find the study on their website, and you can also find a video of the presentation that was done just last week, and this was in mid-October, which I think is quite instructive, and I hope is helping us to shift this conversation from one that is looking at what might, you know, frankly, to one that should be looking at how we as institutions have systems and processes in place that may be creating some of the impediments to people of color advancing.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of things along those lines where you have to have a four-year college degree. For a lot of jobs, you don't, and automatically eliminate so many people. I had a fellow on the program who was talking about the perfect cover letter and how the English has to be just so or you get eliminated. He says, well, I speak five languages. You know what I mean? He says, English is my fifth language. He says, does that count for anything? And I sometimes think those, you know, rules for entry can be pretty difficult. Let me close with this, Jim. The very best cultures that I've spoken to are never happy with the status quo. They're always looking to get better and better and better, continuous improvement. What's the thing that you would like to do at the Barr Foundation to take it to the next level and get even better than you are now?
Well, let me just pick up on your question, and then I will aim to answer it, and just say that there's a great one of my favorite books is a book by Tom Tierney and Joel Fleischman called Give Smart that speaks about philanthropy and what makes for effective philanthropy. And there's a wonderful line in that book, which is that in philanthropy, excellence is self-imposed. And I think that's absolutely true. And so I think a lot about how we ensure that this institution, which, you know, doesn't have shareholders asking for, about the bottom line, which doesn't have voters that are going to elect us in or out, I think we have to be performing at a level that we are constantly asking ourselves, are we doing enough? Are we advancing this work as quickly and as urgently as we can? We have to continually be imposing that excellence on ourselves. So I think a lot about how we ensure that we don't allow that spirit of complacency or, more insidiously, that arrogance that can somehow get into foundations from time to time, you know, to make sure that those qualities don't in any way enter this culture. So I think for us, continuing to have a high bar, continuing to have high expectations of ourselves, continuing to ask ourselves the question, are we taking sufficient risk with our work? Because I believe firmly that if we're not failing with some of the things that we're doing, then probably we're not taking sufficient risk.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that as an important part of the culture and an important part of how we propel the work that we've been privileged to do thus far to the next stage.
Well, Jim Canales, the president of the Barr Foundation, thanks so much for being here and sharing these just wonderful insights. It was great to have you on the program again.
Well, thank you again, and what a pleasure to be with you.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Top companies have now begun to discover a reliable source for skilled new talent, and they're finding great success with employees who are productive, engaged, and innovative. Explore the country's largest untapped talent pool, 24 million Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner for companies looking to accelerate their disability employment efforts, attract, hire, and retain. Learn more at NOD.org. Youth opportunities, strong communities, a healthy planet. Sounds like the work of social entrepreneurs. Yes, but it's also the work of artists. Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Upstart is committed to promoting artists as innovators, unleashing capital for creativity, and enabling sustainable creative lives. Find out more at www.upstartco-lab.org.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
This evening, we will be taking a trip to Bethesda, Maryland, and to the offices of Child Trends. Child Trends is the nation's leading nonprofit research organization focused exclusively on improving the lives and prospects of children, youth, and their families. It's also a perennial on the best places to work list, and we'll hear from the members of the staff to find out why.
I was really attracted to Child Trends because it does prioritize making itself a great place to work very publicly and visibly. And I think that says a lot about an organization's priorities behind the scenes when they do want people to know that they're on these lists of great places to work. And when they do, when they are very transparent about their benefits. And I appreciate the flexibility in terms of people are given, in my brief experience, a lot of autonomy to determine their own schedules to do what works best for them.
One of the most amazing things is that we are able to really work on the projects that interest us most. So I'm on the education team at Child Trends, but I don't have to work solely on education projects. I work on youth development projects. I work on indicators projects because we really want to kind of spread our wings to the topics that interest us most. And Child Trends really gives us the groundwork to do that and really encourages us to pursue the projects that are really, you know, inspire us and that we're passionate about.
Child Trends really provides the support to let people grow at their own pace and grow into positions that they want to be in. So one of the unique things at Child Trends is, although we have, you know, our set positions of, you know, a research scientist or a research analyst, you can create your own job title if those titles don't fit what you want to be doing. So I think that's a really unique aspect of Child Trends.
And so we need to be kind of good models for our junior staff in doing that. And then I personally have a bad habit of working too much, and I get kind of kindly reprimanded by some of our senior leadership. One time I made the mistake of sending a draft of a report to our president at 10 p.m. And the next morning she sat me down and told me about that I shouldn't have to work that much and that I should never feel pressured to be working that late at night. And so it's always a good reminder when you're just continually being reinforced that you matter, your health matters, your family matters, and I really appreciate that.
One of the things I'd want to touch on with feedback is that we have this little informal system of gold stars that are little sheets of paper that people can find. You can also send them remotely, and they're intended to be either anonymous or you can put your name on them, but someone can write a nice little gold star recognizing anyone in their office, whether above, below, at any level, just thanking them for something that they did particularly well. So you'll often walk through the hallways and see a bunch of gold stars on people's offices.
An idea can literally come from anywhere within the organization. And those, it can range from, you know, ways to improve conditions for children to ways that we improve Child Trends itself, such as what Esther was describing. But it's also notable that when these ideas come up, this is an organization that gets excited about them. They're not met with, oh, more work to do. It sounds great, but oh, there's more work to do. That's not how it's received at all. People will sort of light up, feed into it, and sort of work around the person that suggested it to build it up and up and up. And it doesn't always go somewhere, but that, you know, that excitement is the first response to a new idea that, you know, may mean a little bit more work, is really kind of refreshing. And I think that's sort of, you know, one of the sources of Child Trends energy, is this sort of natural excitement for the work that we do here.
That's one of the things that we're looking for when we are hiring is, are you passionate? Are you passionate about kids? Are you passionate about the work you're doing? Or is this just going to be another job? I think that's one of the hallmarks of the people who work here, is that this is not just another job for them. They are very much passionate about kids, passionate about the topic areas that we're working on, and have ideas of how to grow.
And then we have these, we call them the grids. So essentially every single level at Child Trends, from the most junior employee to the most senior, there's a grid, and it has all of these different competencies like technical work experience, thought leadership, client development. And we're not expected to necessarily hit everything and every one of those, but it's nice because you can see what the positions kind of above you are and what you need to be doing technically to get a promotion. And so I really like the transparency of that.
And often when there's some type of policy change, one of the perfect examples is when we moved from annual performance reviews to annual goal setting and a culture of feed forward, we weren't just handed this decision with no explanation. Instead, we got an explanation of the research that went into this and the reason why we were making this decision. And we also had opportunities for people to make comments about the policy, and it was announced at an all staff so that anyone could raise their hand and raise any concerns that they had or any suggestions that they had. And often we'll have a question and answer session that happens afterwards that people can attend and give their feedback and their thoughts. So I really appreciated that transparency in how decisions are made.
I was thinking some about the hiring process and what it meant for our culture. A person does not interview you at Child Trends. The whole organization interviews you.
And once hired, I was also really, really impressed by how soon I felt like I belonged in the organization. I remember it was just a matter of a couple weeks before I really felt a sense of ownership over my tasks, the projects I was working on, and a huge amount of motivation to learn and contribute at the organization, as well as lots of acceptance of my ideas, my perspectives, and lots of faith in the work that I was doing. Obviously, there was review and oversight, but I was impressed by how much they were willing to say, okay, Sam, see what you can do with this, and the independence that I had even as a junior employee.
I want to thank all of those who participated and contributed to this piece: Susan Balding, John Belford, Sam Beckwith, Deborah Temkin, Kelly Murphy, Esther Gross, and Kristen Harper. If you should want to hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants and the offices of Child Trends, you can do all that by simply going to denver-frederick.com.
You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
40% of new leaders fail in their first 18 months. That is both costly and disruptive to an organization, and not very good for those individuals either. But a firm that has diagnosed the problem and has helped to improve that batting average significantly is Prime Genesis. And joining us tonight is their chairman and founder, George Bratt. Good evening, George, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening. I'm delighted to be here.
So tell us why 2 out of 5 executives transitioning into a new position will just not succeed.
In general, it's because of 1 of 3 reasons, in order of priority. It's either because they don't fit, they don't deliver, or they can't adjust to changes down the road. And I can go a little deeper on that if you'd like me to.
Please do.
So fit is the biggest issue, and it's a cultural thing. This manifests itself in somebody saying, they just didn't fit, or the person coming in saying, you know, they weren't who I expected them to be. And it's a big deal, and you have to solve this before you either hire the person, or if you're the person coming into the company, before you actually accept the job. So that's fit. Fit is the matchup of culture and preferences. Delivery is not getting done what needs to get done. And this is the second big thing. And gosh, everybody's seen this or heard this. people going, oh, they just couldn't get it done. But if you ask them, they say, you know, the organization didn't give me the resources I needed to get done what I needed to get done. So delivery is the second big issue. And then the third one is adjustment. I mean, things change. Things always change. And people that fail, not in the first couple of months, but later down the road, fail because they couldn't adjust to an external or internal change after they got their new boss, competitors doing something different, reorganization, where they just get thrown and can't cope.
I have to have that adaptive mindset. Well, one of the ways you try to address this with your clients is to develop with them a 100-day action plan. Why is that so important, and what are some of the elements of that plan?
It's important because preparation breeds confidence. If you have a plan, even if you don't follow it exactly, which nobody does, and there's a lot of people who take credit for saying this, but no plan survives the first punch in the face. No plan survives the first interaction with the enemy, whatever it is.
Exactly.
Plans change. But if you have a plan, preparation breeds confidence. And the elements of the way we think about it really comes down to four things. One is getting a head start. Two is managing your message. Three is setting direction and building your team. And then three is sustaining momentum and adjusting to changes down the road, nicely geared to counteract the three reasons people fail. And I can go deeper onto any of those. I mean, as you know, I've written 6 books on the subject. But
absolutely, yeah.
Does that give you the headlines you're looking for?
Those were good. Well, you know, there's been a seismic shift in this war for talent. What has occurred in recent years, George, and what do organizations need to be thinking about and doing to successfully adjust?
Yeah, it's three things. Two of them are closely related, and a lot of it's demographic. It's baby boomers and millennials would be the thing that I think is going on. What you've got is the baby boomers effectively moving out of the workforce.
Yeah.
So there's this big knot of now more senior experienced people that are going out, so there's leadership vacuums in a lot of places. Closely related to that is, over the short term, over more recently, as the economies have done well, unemployment's dropped, so there's less people, and there's certainly less really good people.
Mm-hmm.
So good people don't have to change, and they don't have to move, so it's hard to get them. The second piece, then, is the millennials. And every generation thinks they're different than the ones before, and everybody thinks, oh my gosh, what's the matter with kids these days? But the millennials are really different because of the internet, and it's because of the access they have to data, where, as somebody said, you know, nobody has the excuse for not knowing something. You can find out anything.
Yep.
And so that's changed. It's made the talent market more transparent. So you've got these junior people, you're losing the experienced people, and the junior people know more than you ever thought they would.
Mm-hmm. Let me pick up on something you said a moment ago about cultural fit. And is there anything you can do in the hiring process, both the employer and the job seeker, to assure that there is going to be a fit?
Not so much assure, but one of the things that I push people to do really hard, and there's this magic moment where, let's imagine, for some crazy reason, you've offered me a job to come work for you, which you would never do. But let's assume you've lost your mind, and you've offered me a job, and you take me out to lunch, and you offer me a job, and I say yes. What do you do next?
I would probably talk about our common ground and how we were going to start, get your thinking on it, and share with you what the day-to-day responsibilities were going to be. And I'd do something along those lines. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's a good answer. That's a good answer. There's nothing wrong with that answer, and that's, you know, close to what some people would say. What I suggest is, if you've offered me a job and I've said yes, the first thing you should say is, wonderful, fabulous, but I can't let you accept yet. Because before you let me accept, you want me to do a real due diligence, and you want to help me do it. Because I've been giving you answers to your interview questions in a job interview, and I've been honest, but I may not have been completely honest. And you've been giving me answers to my questions as you've been recruiting me, but there may be some things that I don't know. It is in your best interest for me to take some time, a couple of days, week, whatever, to really dig in and really understand the culture so I can make my assessment of the fit.
Mm-hmm.
And doing this does a couple of wonderful things. The biggest is you let me help figure out whether it's a fit, because fit by definition goes two ways. The second thing is, you've completely changed the nature of our relationship in our first conversation. Because instead of being the used car salesman trying to get me to accept a job, which you probably want me to do, even if you've lost your mind and are offering me a job, you've come around to my side of the table and we're partners.
Mm-hmm.
And you are going to work with me to make sure it's the right thing for me and the organization, so we fit better.
Well, let me pick it up on that point. Let's talk about onboarding and how it relates to all new hires in a company or organization. Why do you think that's so important, George, and what are some of the keys to doing that effectively?
Well, it's hugely important, right back to your first point, because 40% of people fail in their 40% of leaders fail in the first 18 months, and that's just talking about the ones that get fired, forced out, or quit. There's a whole bunch of other people that fail on the job and don't live up to expectations and don't do what you want them to do. So onboarding can help with that. And the trick to it is, people have been thinking about it too narrowly.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's about helping somebody on their first day, or helping somebody get their computer or desk or whatever. And we suggest that onboarding starts even before the first contact with a new employee or leader or whatever. And we suggest five stages. There's an acquisition stage, there's an accommodation stage, there's an assimilation stage, there's an acceleration stage, and all those are predated by an alignment stage. So what you want to do is, you want to get everybody, so step one is get everybody aligned around what you want this new employee to do. This is where you flesh out things like conflict, internal conflicts of interest. In acquiring, this is about recruiting, identifying, selecting, wooing. Accommodating is about making sure they can do work on day one. All this happens before day one.
Yep.
And then assimilating is welcoming them and making sure that they can do work with others in the organization, and that's, you know, day one and the early weeks and whatever. And then don't give up on it, because this onboarding stuff lasts far longer than you think it should, and that's the accelerating stage where you help them and their team continue to grow.
You know, you've promoted this concept of brave leadership. What are its elements? And describe for us the brave framework, if you will.
Thank you for asking about that. I'm learning to love this one. So brave has two meanings. One is courageous. Leaders should be courageous. And secondly, it's an acronym for behaviors, relationships, attitudes, values, and the environment. And I've found it to be ridiculously applicable to a whole bunch of different situations. Companies, innovation, recruiting, you know, pick it. And so we tackle it from the outside in. Environment is about where to play, and that gives you your context. Values are about what matters and why. That's about getting everybody aligned around purpose. Attitude is about how to win. These are choices, and here you need one overarching strategic posture as well as sub-strategies. Relationships is the heart of leadership. It's about how to connect. Leadership is about inspiring and enabling others. You do that through your relationship. You do that through your communication. And all of this is theoretical gibberish until you get to behaviors, where people actually do things. And that goes to what impact, and that's implementation. It's a nice, simple framework that we've used in a lot of situations, and it allows people to stop and think, where am I? What are these the answers to these five questions? How do I move forward?
I can see why it would work. And when you work with your clients, George, do you consider yourself and your role to be more that of a consultant, or would it be that of a coach?
So it doesn't really matter. I think we're some sort of blend.
Yeah.
We're really transition accelerators. There's definitely a part of this that is coaching. There's a part of this that's consulting. But what we do, we are to consultants and coaches like a bakery is to a supermarket. If you go to any management consultant you know and say, hey, I'm going to a new job, will you help me create and work through my first 100 days? They're going to say yes, as will any coach. But don't, and, you know, you walk into any supermarket and ask for a loaf of bread, they're all going to say yes, and some of them have great bread. Just don't walk into my bakery and ask for a leg of lamb. You know, we're as good as it gets because of our team, tools, and focus. This is all we do.
Let me close with this, George. What do you see as the future of work being? What's around the bend that both job seekers and organizations really need to be prepared for?
I think it comes down to happiness. And my theory of happiness, and your listeners should write this down, happiness is good. And actually, it's three goods. It's doing good for others, it's doing things people are good at, and it's doing good for me.
Mm-hmm.
And the future of work is about different organizations balancing those things right for the different individuals. Surprise, surprise. Some organizations, like some nameless investment banks, may be a little more focused on doing good for me, and some of the nonprofits that are listening on here may be a little more focused on doing good for others. Everybody needs all three, just in different balances. And the future work is the organizations that can figure that out for the people they're recruiting and onboarding and leading will do better.
Well, George Bratt, the founder and CEO of Prime Genesis, thanks for joining us this evening. Why don't you tell us about your website and some of the information you have up there for those who come visit?
So the website is very simple. It's www.primegenesis.com, and it's got all sorts of interesting things, including access to my Forbes articles and links to our books and blog posts around executive and team onboarding.
Well, thanks, George. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
Edition of Better Than Most, we're going to visit the American Heart Association. And when they put together those lists of best places to work, the American Heart Association is often one of the few nonprofit organizations that is included. We will start with their CEO, Nancy Brown, and then hear from members of the AHA team from around the country.
I believe that culture is job number one. We're so fortunate in the not-for-profit sector, and we certainly feel this way at the American Heart Association, that every single day our staff and our volunteers work on behalf of the association because we have such an important mission to fulfill. Cardiovascular diseases are the number one killer of people in the U.S. and worldwide, and we have so much work to do to be able to help people have a healthier life. And so at the core of our corporate culture is this focus on our purpose and the reason that we exist and how we can utilize the diverse talents and skills of our employees and our volunteers to create, you know, new innovative approaches to helping people live longer lives.
The culture of the American Heart Association is outstanding for very many ways. We are divided into seven different affiliates, and I am proud to be in the Greater Southeast affiliate. One of the ways that we have been able to define our culture has been dividing up into different teams and creating fun mascots. And so my team in the Northern Southeast is the Glacier Cats. You may recognize that name. They were a minor league hockey team in Arkansas that is no longer in existence. But that has been an incredible rally cry to help define our culture. Everybody recognizes with the Glacier Cats. We have hashtags that we send out regularly through emails. We send Snapchats and videos of encouragement to people. And it's really helped build our culture.
And we always are just driven by the stories of our survivors and the people who have overcome so much from heart disease and stroke. And so the culture is driven around the idea that people have been through so much and we're working every day to improve the lives of other individuals. And I think it's just a great place to work. We're always happy. We're always empowering individuals. We're always working towards a greater goal. And so the culture here is optimistic. It's inspiring to work here. And everything that we do revolves around that core mission of our great organization.
When we come here, we know every single day we are working really hard to save lives. And that is why we show up every day and work tremendously hard. All of our teams, no matter what area of focus that you're in, and my work is in government relations, we know that our work changes lives. We know that ultimately when we put in that 110%, we are helping define someone's legacy. And that is tremendously impactful. And that is a corporate culture that we take very seriously. And it's something that we're tremendously proud of as staff members. And you can see that on people's faces. We take this job very seriously. I think if you were to talk to anybody, we would say this job is a tremendous gift. But there's a lot of responsibility coming with that gift too, knowing that you really are making a difference in someone's life and you need to take that very seriously. We have a great coach from National that gives some great advice and offers some feedback of different situations you might be in and you might be faced with. And then from there, you have monthly webinars that you participate in with also homework and some great articles to read and TED Talks and different things that you're exposed to that you might not normally look into yourself. So it kind of gave, you know, a different topic every month and helped you explore a different area of management. And it was very eye-opening and a great way to collaborate with peers from across our region, which is an 8-state region, to learn more and to have that, like I said, that peer-to-peer relationship so you can work with people who are maybe new to managing and discuss different scenarios. We have a tradition in the Cincinnati office of getting together and doing speed dating, which is where we go. It's sort of like speed dating, but traditional, what you've heard about. But you're paired with another member of your team, and we mix it up and we share what we're working on, and we have several questions and answer period. But we not only share what we're working on, we also share some personal information so we are able to get to know each other better, since we are in so many different aspects of working with the AHA. But I really feel that this has really helped us break down silos within the office so that we're not just the development team isn't together versus the communication staff or the health strategy staff.
I think it goes back to something I said earlier, and that is that innovation and this burning desire to make a difference has been at the roots of the American Heart Association since 1924. If you go back and read the early writings of one of our six founders, Dr. Paul Dudley White, you will see this dissatisfaction with the status quo. Mm. You will see this call to action to change the world for people, and we continue to live by that mantra today.
You're working for a company that would really love to not exist in the future. And how many companies, how many organizations can say that they, every single day, their mission is to put themselves out of business? And those are the kinds of things that are really, you know, you have to instill into employees, that every day when you sit down at your desk in your home office, you're working hard to save lives. And that underlying passion, I think, is a big piece of that. And yeah, it gets woven into the onboarding and the training and the conference calls and the conversations. And every day, you know, we hear these incredible survivor stories or incredible stories of people who maybe didn't survive, and they just motivate you all that much more. But there has to be that underlying passion and that underlying drive and desire to really change the world, to really make a lasting change and a lasting impression. And identifying those people is just the key to making sure your culture's on point.
Well, actually, we just started something called Hearts with Pride, which is an LGBTQ employee resource group. And that group meets every other month, and it's individuals that are LGBTQ or allies across the United States, from all different markets. And we talk about ways to outreach to the local LGBTQ communities where we live with heart and stroke awareness information, because there are many health disparities for LGBTQ people. And this is a brand new thing. This has been around for about a year. So those employee resource groups don't just apply to LGBTQ. We have an Asian employee resource group. They're starting a Hispanic employee resource group. So the AHA is really invested in bringing together like-minded people to make changes not only across the United States, but in their own individual communities where they feel the most passionate about.
I was coming from a for-profit organization, and the hiring process was better than that organization. It was something that I didn't really know what to expect. It was very clear communication. There was a recruiter that was in constant contact with me throughout the entire journey, from submitting a resume online to the phone interview. Then we went into a face-to-face interview. then took a skills assessment test online, and then came back for about a, I think it was a two and a half hour face-to-face panel interview. And that really sharpened my personal skills on interviewing, because that's a pretty intense interview process when you're being drilled different questions. But it also speaks to the caliber of people that American Heart Association hires. They take it very seriously and truly only want the best for our organization.
Gone through many performance reviews, but what I really like the best is that there are no surprises. I think that management, the culture of the AHA, is constant communication. So that you, when you walk into your mid-year review or you walk into your final performance review, there really aren't any surprises.
All of that underscores a commitment to excellence that really makes the American Heart Association unique. We're not just a nonprofit. We're not just a, you know, another company. We're not just another business that's working on, you know, working on our bottom line. We have a commitment to excellence, and that is a value that is really instilled in every single aspect of what we do. And it all flows up to that.
You can teach people many things, but you attract people, you know, who have at the core of their being this desire to do good for others, and that's what we have at the American Heart Association.
I want to extend my thanks to Tracy Burdout for organizing this, and to all those who participated: Charlie Haddock, Brenda Vitale, Ryan Johnson, Lori Fovel, Karen Englert, Chrissy Meyer, and Terry Arnold. If you would like to hear this again or read the transcript, you can do so by visiting denver-frederick.com, and we'll have a link there to my full interview with Nancy Brown, the Chief Executive Officer of the American Heart Association. And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great first week of April, and do come back next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.